From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The Reverend Jesse Jackson is nationally known as the founder and president of the Rainbow Push Coalition and his longtime work as one of the nation's foremost civil rights figures. On the local level, he's long been deeply involved in the city of Chicago, which recently created a $5.5 million reparations fund for the victims of police torture from 1972 through the early 1990s. He joins us in Los Angeles to talk about that and other news out of the Windy City, and for that matter, across the nation. Good to see you, Reverend.
To you, sir.
Let me start with this Chicago reparations initiative. Tell me what this is, how it came to be, because there is, when you say the word reparations, people get all kind of skittish.
Repair for some damage done. Mm-hmm. Over the last 10 years, $500 million. That money could have kept schools open and scholarships could have been an agenda, a budget for reconstruction. This young man had been shot 16 times. Rather than show the shooting, they want to give the parents $5 million and not show the film of the shooting. Mm-hmm. It's just that ugly. So when one looks at just the violence, guns in, drugs in, guns out, it's a tragedy.
What will this fund do, and is it your sense that other cities being proactive since these uprisings and these police shootings continue to happen? I should say the police shootings and then the uprisings. Is it your sense that other cities might take on this same kind of tack?
Only to the extent that they feel that a combination of a poverty and neglect and alienation is a fuel. The poverty is a fuel. Mm-hmm. A gunshot lights and it explodes. But there's so much focus to have us on police work and containment, no focus on investment and development. And that's my concern, is that even in the Baltimore situation, the focus, of course, is on the police, the six police, and then the uprising. 18,000 vacant homes are abandoned lots. Where's Secretary of HUD? No one said if you remove 9,000 of those vacant lots and abandoned homes, replace boards of window panes, and remove fixed caving roofs, and remove lead paint to create jobs. 80% of the police live outside of Baltimore, from Virginia to New York. So they come in as occupiers, not as residents. They spend their money outside. They buy the houses outside. They pay the taxes for the children. They get education outside. You got that tension. 35% unemployment. Now, where is the money? The TIF money is downtown on the river, and the private equity investment, and the pension funds, and the bank lending, and the subsidized stadia, Orioles and the Ravens. So it is this predicament. There's so much focus on the riot. There's a daily, constant, perpetual riot of economic violations.
Because you were just a young man at the time working with Dr. King when the Watts riots broke out, and Detroit, and Newark, and. Is there a primary difference, or is there a through line to compare those riots then and these uprisings now?
It is a fair comparison, because invariably one pulls out the Kerner Commission report, mm-hmm. and it says the dangers of having the two societies, one essentially black and brown and poor, one white, one doing well and one doing not so well, that alienation is a gap. And that poverty is a weapon of mass destruction. And that the ignoring poverty allows it to fuel and to fester. And never does pure poverty trigger a rebellion. It's always some oppressive, excessive force that humiliates. The humiliation on top of the poverty is what lights it. And so what it is Rodney King, of what it is the Watts in the 60s, of what it is Ferguson, of what it is Sanford, Florida, of what it is Baltimore, invariably, it is this police as container that triggers the explosion. And I say the container because their job in Baltimore right now, many people say, well, things are quiet. Quietness is the absence of noise. Peace is the presence of justice. There is no justice. There is no peace. There is no basis for peace as long as there is injustice. So I ask, if you've lost 18,000 vacant homes or abandoned lots, where's Secretary of HUD? Where is the Secretary of Commerce Pritzker? Where is the head of the Small Business Administration? Since people can't get the jobs, where's the Department of Transportation? This is an opportunity to put forth an urban reconstruction plan, not just a police containment plan.
Is that an indictment of the Obama administration? You've listed five of his cabinet secretaries.
It's a challenge to the administration and to the country and to the Congress. For example, when President Obama puts forth an Affordable Health Care Act, which is a poverty program in and of itself, since they retook the state houses around the South, a state like South Carolina was 25% in poverty, was sent back $10 billion in Medicaid money, rejected. Alabama, $10 billion. And those in that 25% are veterans and women and children who can't get breast cancer tests, who cannot get mammograms, who cannot get testicular tests. And so the rejection, the headwind of resistance is a factor in this, but they are not funding HUD. EEOC is not, when Eleanor Holmes Norton was in the White House, when Jimmy Carter was president, EEOC was almost a cabinet position. And because it was so prominent, when Reagan came in, he put Clarence Thomas to replace her to undermine the authority of it. Now it's almost underfunded. It almost EEOC, contract compliance, Civil Rights Commission, these agencies have power properly funded, but the Congress does the funding.
When the history books are written on the Obama administration, since you said the administration, in answer to my question, when the history books are written on this administration, will they say that Barack Obama as president was not bold enough or that he was obstructed too often?
I would say obstructed. For example.
Not both?
Could be some combination. I would make this case. The first month he came in office, there were like 800,000 job loss. We've not lost a job a month in 6 years. So at one level, the economy is booming again. But we bail out the banks, not LinkedIn lending, they're reinvesting in those whose homes got taken, targeted 2 million blacks and browns. And they were found guilty of race discrimination. But the fines were not as great as the money they made, not the damage that they did, as a case in point. On the other hand, the Affordable Health Care Act, you have people who've never had an insurance policy before, who now for the first time, poor people, have Medicaid. And there are those who would say, I saw some people in Kentucky say, well, we don't want Obama, because we want affordable health care, because we like being on until you're 26. We like for the first time getting these various tests. They want an omelet, but don't want the egg. It's just a lot of mean stuff going on. And so I think there is a very violent headwind that's undermining. I mean, the fact is, many of these agencies are not funded anymore, and Congress does the funding.
What is your sense of the state or lack thereof of progressive politics? Bernie Sanders, of course, is running for the Democratic nomination, as you did in 84 and 88. But top line for me, the state, the dire state of progressive politics in America.
I don't hear enough discussion about poverty. Dr. King's last stage of our struggle, assuming first stage is end slavery, 246 years, and the second stage to end legal Jim Crow, the third stage to right the vote. He said, having had all of those victories, you still must have a job, an income, a floor beneath which no one falls, must address the issue of access to capital, industry, technology, deal flow, and poverty. There's a fear of some sort dealing with the question of poverty because it will cost. Faith and hope don't have budgets attached to them. It is the substance of things hoped for that matters. We were in Selma this past year, and two things struck me about it. Three things. One, how many people are there who were not registered to vote? That struck me kind of odd. The second piece of it was focusing on the voting rights that we won in 65, not the one we lost in 2013, because Shelby Trump Selma by removing Section 4. But the third one was that while we celebrated what all had happened in Selma 50 years ago, Miss Boynton, who invited Dr. King to Selma, as Rosa Parks was the feature in Montgomery, her house is now condemned. Up and down the street are bathrooms, toilets in the backyard. That Dallas County is now 40% in poverty, 65% for kids in poverty. So voting rights, as Lyndon Johnson would say, without economic reconstruction is fallow. And that becomes today's unfinished business, the issue of reviving a war on poverty that's funded. We cannot just join the status quo. We must change it. As Dr. King would say, leaders at their best don't follow opinion polls. They mold them. And so the issue of the reason why we focus on Silicon Valley, for example, you know, we came north other than refugees because of Lynching, came north, the jobs in the automotive industry. Now you've got the most robust industry in the history of the earth, the high-tech industry, and driven out of the technology, driven out of the Defense Department, out of the defense industry. And Tavish, the top 20 companies, 189 board members, 36 white women, 3 blacks, 1 Latino. In that valley, the C-suite's like 370, 3 blacks and 3 Latino. Employment around a steady 2%. We're over-indexing it. Apple, Google, we're over-indexing in all of them. And that's for startups, investment, almost none. And we have both the legal right through EEOC and contract compliance and the economic leverage and the moral right to fight to change those conditions, and we are.
So what do you say to a company like Facebook meeting this week, in fact? What will you, I assume you head up to Silicon Valley after you leave here.
Indeed, I'm saying to them, you look at your end, because we have enough shares to get to the floor. You have an all-white board. If you complain about an all-white country club at Augusta National Guard, but what about an all-white board? They're replacing Donald Graham now with another white. So even through attrition, we're not been allowed in. And so fighting for racial justice.
So Facebook has an all-white board.
All-white board, and Apple has an all-white board. And substantial others of them, most of them have all-white boards. But you know, the issue is not just the boards. That's a highly credible, pivotal, visible position. But the EEO-1 reports, that's where the real struggle came. When we said, well, show us your EEO-1 reports. They said, well, it'll give us competitive disadvantage. They were embarrassed by the numbers. Because these companies they have the liberal facade, you know, no neckties and shoes and no socks, cool kind of guys. But at the end of the day, the patterns of exclusion are quite pronounced.
Hillary Clinton is going to raise a lot of money in that valley where you're going tomorrow, Silicon. If I can appropriate the language of my grandmother, is she the answer to the prayer in 2016?
If we put the agenda and she reaches the bar, she will not inherit this position. She'll have to fight for it. I first met her many years ago, giving legal services for the poor. And so I identify her very much with that. You recall during that thesis, she was on the board, the Children's Defense Fund for Mary Wright Edelman. Mm-hmm. So her sensitivity to the poor, while she's driven to extremely high heights, I think that is a baseline that she represents of sensitivity. But I think that becomes our duty to raise the right questions and create the right expectation. There's all the talk about faith and hope. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. Faith doesn't have a budget. Hope doesn't have a budget. The substance of things. I mean, we lost these, lost our middle class, lost 2 million affordable housing, wiped out. That was a big hit. And when those houses went, poverty came in and tax base dropped. And therefore you can't fund the schools. Chicago, man, 50 public schools closed. 50 drugstores.
No, they didn't close. They were closed.
Were closed.
Yeah.
50 drugstores.
Yeah.
75 grocery stores. Trauma units closed. One side of town on Inglewood and on that side of the town, south side, and on Austin west side.
Yeah.
You've got 30% unemployment. On the north side, around 3% unemployment, where the institutional infrastructure is, and the suburb jobs wanted signs. But there is no plan for reconstruct. There's no plan. When you close public housing and privatize and foreclose private housing, you have homelessness. And therefore, this issue of poverty and those locked out remains my obsession.
I like Hillary just like you do. Love Hillary, respect Hillary. And yet for some, on certain issues, she is not progressive enough. For some, she is too hawkish on foreign policy. Your thoughts?
I think those are issues that are up for discussion. And I would be inclined to support her in part because there's no alternative, but also in part I think she has the capacity to hear people, not just as a ceremonial hear people. I think she can hear people. Now I look at her and I look at the alternative. I look at guys who declare on the right wing that they will stand their ground against Medicaid for the poor. That they were in South Carolina where you have 25% of the prison labor force is rented out to private companies. as in post-slavery, when they were turned back $2 million education money and almost about to close South Carolina State. Now, look at this right-wing alternative that kind of revived of the Confederacy. It makes her glow get even brighter.
How is she going to do this interesting dance to avoid the issues that Bill Clinton was wrong about during his presidency? And Bill Clinton did a lot of good, but there are things that we now know with hindsight that were mistakes. How will she, and we see this debate every day in the newspaper, about how she's going to do this dance to distance herself from stuff that she stood with her husband on then?
I think she knows that the growth, the jail industrial complex under Bill Clinton was huge mistakes. Three strikes and you're out sounded very good for some people as opposed to four balls in your own. We locked up thousands, if not millions, unnecessarily and built an industry around locking up people who, in fact, should have been somewhere getting away already and becoming criminals. So she'll have to make a great business from that. And now that you have these privatized prisons, you have prisons for profit and prison labor, and we become addicted to the need for it. And so it's going to be some. But when you begin to move those people out of that, then where do those people go? And that's where this whole issue of tech fits in. And she's in this issue of the in Iraq. We act as if the war started a few days ago. The first meeting President Bush had, cabinet meeting, and that meeting was how do we take Iraq back? That was Colin Powell's tension with the Bush forces. And we use as a pretense the war. We destroyed the civilization. My last conversation with Saddam Hussein, when I went there to get the Americans out, who were being held to shield, he said, Reverend, said they're itching to come in here, and I can't stop them from coming in. It'd be easier to get in than to get out. Boy, was he telling the truth.
There is a movie already controversial, and Spike hadn't even started filming yet. But there's a movie that Spike Lee's working on called Chirac, and for those who haven't heard about it, it's Chicago and Iraq, Chirac. And there are folk who even hate that term and what it suggests. And Spike, again, hasn't even started filming yet. What's this? What's your take on this controversy?
This weekend, 12 people killed, 2 injured, Chirac. We lost more people in Chicago this weekend than we lost in Iraq. And so Spike is using his creativity. I just hope, in addition to showing the pain and the murders and the loss of children and the police alienation, that the context of it, out of this Chirac is coming a whole notion that when we know where the guns are manufactured, we know where 70% of them who kill people are sold and they become straw purchases, we know there's guns in, drugs in, jobs out. So it's not enough to show just the glamour, the painful glamour of the shootings, but the context that there's a remedy for this. We must revive a war on poverty and not just on the poor.
The best of you tomorrow at the Facebook board meeting, or shareholder meeting, I should say.
Facebook shareholder meeting tomorrow and Google next week.
Yep.
We're not going to turn them loose because this, and by the way, I'm trying to get 1,000 churches to set up Texans in their churches so our youth can begin to embrace stock market game and codes and apps. This is an industry we can capture based on our creativity, we must be introduced to it, and we intend to do the introducing in the Rainbow Push.
The founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition, Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Hey, see you, Reverend. At Rev J. Jackson?
Yes.
And follow me on Facebook.
Oh, Lord, not you too. Not you too.
Hey, man, at Rev.
Jesse Jackson has gone social media, homie. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Deepak Chopra, founder of the Chopra Center for Well-Being, is a prolific writer, to say the least. He's the author of more than 80 books, including 22 New York Times bestsellers. He joins us now to talk about his latest work, The 13th Disciple, an adventure novel with deep religious themes that takes its readers on a unique spiritual journey. Deepak, good to have you back on this program.
Thanks, Tavis. Good
to see you, man. When I got the book, I grabbed it and turned it over, and on the back of it, there's some wonderful blurbs. So I started reading the names on the blurbs. Marianne Williamson, makes sense. Maria Shriver, makes sense. Wayne Dyer, makes sense. Mikhail Gorbachev?
Yeah, Gorbachev in his later years has become very interesting. philosophy in the deeper understanding of peace, equanimity, love, joy, the themes that are part of all spiritual traditions.
Yeah. What is it about his former life as a head of state that you think leads him to this journey? And I'm asking because I wonder whether or not there are other heads of state who might be benefited from going on the kind of search that you say Mr. Gorbachev is on now.
Well, Mr. Gorbachev initiated glasnost, perestroika, so he was already, in a way, disenchanted with the rigid communist ideology, and he was looking to become an international leader. He was more accepted, actually, outside of the communist Soviet Union than inside. But ever since his retirement, he's really focused on, you know, human potential and what it takes to unleash our creativity, imagination, insight for a better world.
Yeah. Before I move on to the text specifically, what I'm trying to figure out the right way to phrase this, since we're talking about world leaders here, what counsel, what counsel, what advice, what direction would you be giving to heads of state if you were convening?
Well, heads of state are actually prisoners of special interest groups,
sure,
no matter who they are.
To be sure.
Once they leave, they have an opportunity to become international leaders. And for that, it takes authenticity, integrity, a higher calling, and
they can't possess any of those qualities while they're in leadership?
Well,
integrity and...
There are 28 healthcare lobbyists for every congressman.
Yeah.
Just healthcare.
Yeah.
If you look at all the lobbyists in Washington, this is not a democracy. This is ruled by special interest groups. You know, and that includes the military, the pharmaceutical industry, the people who produce mechanized death, GMO foods. We are prisoners.
So what does that say then about our leadership class in our body politic?
Our leadership class is imprisoned by special interest groups, and partly we are responsible because we vote for these congressmen, and we vote very selfishly right now, just for ourselves.
Yeah. So this book, The 13th Disciple, is, to use your phrase, a teaching novel.
Yes.
So what might this novel teach those leaders and all the rest of us?
Well, there are many ways of looking at the world and also looking at our own consciousness. Mm-hmm. So the characters in this book represent contemporary views about what is reality. There's militant atheists, there are agnostics, there are fundamental religion people, there are seekers, there are mystics, and there's something called enlightened awareness. So this book is a journey to move from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum. It's not necessarily about religion, but about a deeper spirituality which says, how can we harness our creativity and our awareness for a more peaceful, just, sustainable, healthier, and happier world?
Leave your hands right where they are on those chairs. Yeah. What's at this end of the spectrum and what's at that end? I don't want to say good or
this
bad,
is,
right or wrong.
Okay, this end of the spectrum is the most narrowed sense of awareness, which would be constricted awareness that comes from fear, anxiety, stress, anger, hostility, resentment, guilt, shame, and depression. Mm-hmm. This end, extreme end, is love, compassion, joy, equanimity, transcendence, truth, goodness, beauty, harmony, imagination, insight, intention, all the things that actually make us human. Not that these don't, but we have to actually now move to the stage. Otherwise, we're risking our own extinction.
What are those things on that end of the spectrum, Deepak, that make us fundamentally human seem so hard to come by for so many of us?
We have been bamboozled by a media and a zeitgeist that says that the way to happiness is to grab as much as you can, as quickly as you can, for yourself. Become a hoarder, basically. It's the hypnosis of our social conditioning.
And we push back on that, how?
It's the fundamental ontology. You know, ontology means how we look at being, of materialism, physicalism, it's even our science, which is splitting the observer from the observed. Our science is based on an artificial split, a subject-object split, looks at nature out there, something to conquer, when in fact we are an activity of nature. So we need to go back to our relationship with nature and understand that those trees are our lungs. The earth is recycling as our body. The rivers are our circulation. This air is our breath. And the star stuff, the carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen that comes from distant galaxies is actually the molecules of your body. We don't see it that way. We see it as something out there which we have to conquer. And we pollute it, we destroy it, and in so doing, we destroy ourselves.
So then how does Deepak Chopra deal every day with the pushback against the science that is often courtesy of those leaders we talked about earlier in Washington who have no regard for it?
Yes, the science is only perpetuates the vicious cycle of cronyism, power-mongering, influence peddling, corruption, bureaucracy, all of that. The only way we can get there, Tavis, is through a critical mass of people who want to be the change they want to see in the world. Mm-hmm. Mahatma Gandhi, mm-hmm. Martin Luther King Jr., they said that. Mm-hmm. Can you be the change you want to see in the world? It's hard enough to change ourselves. We can't expect other people to change so that we feel better. We have to take the journey ourselves.
Is that change still possible, or you think the damage done in some respects, in some spheres, is already irreparable?
It seems irreparable, and yet we have the resources to actually tackle everything, poverty, social inequality, sustainability, creative solutions to war and technology, mechanized death. We have all the resources. It needs love, and it needs action, and it needs creativity. It needs a critical mass. It needs the help of media, of entertainment, of music, of storytellers, of education, of social networks. If we can harness this collective creativity, because, you know, when you see totalitarian regimes, what mm-hmm. do they do? They go after the artists. Mm-hmm. The artists are the soul mm-hmm. of communities. The artists are the soul of a nation. We need the artists to come forward and say, we are going to create the new zeitgeist.
I'm not sure I disagree with you, but you've said it two or three times now. What is your, unpack for me, your indictment of the media?
The media is melodramatic.
I love that. It's so true.
It's sensational. The more melodramatic and the more, you know, the more negative the story is, it's in melodrama and sensationalism, mm-hmm. the more it sells. So it's this constant cycle. The media feeds this kind of stuff, and then, you know, people want this kind of stuff too.
I want to circle back to your book, The 13th Disciple, because what we've been talking about here essentially is the journey that all of us are on, or at mm-hmm. least need to be on, mm-hmm. To become our best selves. Tell me about the journey that Mayer is on in the book.
Mayer is the seeker here. She wants to understand, what is reality? Is reality what we experience through our senses? Mm-hmm. By the way, that we don't know how our senses create this three-dimensional world in space and time. All that's going to your brain right now from your eyes is an electrical current. Mm-hmm. That's all. And in your brain, all that's happening is chemistry. You experience a three-dimensional world in space and time. This is called the hard question in science today. Mm-hmm. We cannot answer this question. How do we experience the physical world? This world that we see cannot fit inside my brain, only chemicals. Mm-hmm. So how does that happen? Science doesn't know. Science has no idea how we experience a mental world. But the great spiritual traditions have said, and that goes back every tradition, you know, I am the light of the world. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? What is I am? I am is the light of consciousness. I am is the light of awareness. When we take away all our conditioning, see, I am Deepak Chopra as a conditioned self, but I am before Deepak Chopra is mm-hmm. not conditioned. It's the whole self. That's why in every tradition, God is the I am that is the I am.
I am that I am, yeah.
Yeah.
Why I want to close, Rob. I could talk to you for hours, but I want to close where I began. I refer to this as a teaching novel. It is. Why a teaching novel as opposed to?
People love stories.
Yeah.
And the more you can give information and knowledge and even wisdom through a story, the more likely you are to be heard.
Yeah. He is so wise. And every time he's on this program, I learn something, and I learn even more when I read his books, novels or otherwise. The latest from Deepak Chopra, a perennial New York Times bestselling author, is called The 13th Disciple, A Spiritual Adventure. The title just got me, The 13th Disciple.
The 13th is the state of consciousness.
Absolutely. That's what made me want to read it. What does Deepak mean by The 13th Disciple?
Thank you.
I got it. Thank you, sir. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. In 2010, Columbia University teaching fellow and poet Gregory Pardlow completed his book, Digest. For the next 4 years, the collection of poems was rejected by every major publishing house. Digest was finally printed in 2014 by a small house, Four Way Books. And today, the major publishers are probably still kicking themselves because, just last month, Gregory Pardlow and his book earned the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. He joins us now to talk about his time in publishing Purgatory and the inspiration for his best-selling work. Greg, good to have you on the program, and congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
What did I get wrong, or what did I not put enough into to explain how this book floated all around New York City?
Well, it's a common story, actually, for books of poems to make the rounds to a lot of publishers. Mm-hmm. So it's a romantic story of, with all the rejections. Yeah. And we like to hear that story, and it's true.
Yeah.
But it's not uncommon for the major publishers to pass on a manuscript. And when it came down to it, it took my publisher, Martha Rhodes of Four Way Books, who saw in the manuscript something that she could work with. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like even after the book was accepted, it was just, she just submitted it off to, sent it off to the publisher. We still sat down and revised and did some more work with the manuscript. But major publishers usually are not interested in doing that kind of work.
What did she see, Martha?
Martha.
Mm-hmm. What did Martha see that the others didn't see in your work?
I think she would have seen, she knew me personally, first of all. And she knew that how hard I was willing to work on the poems to move them to a place where, she also knew that I'm interested in taking my poems to places that are perhaps uncomfortable and to speaking into silences. And so I think it was my ambition that she recognized in the work. That
when you say that you are comfortable with taking your work, I'm paraphrasing here,
sure,
that you are comfortable taking your work into uncomfortable places, what do you mean by that?
Well, growing up in my family, and I guess in anybody's family, we have myths, we have these stories that are these places where we don't talk about, and even in our own lives. And I've always been interested in speaking into those spaces, And so there are. So one of the things I'm interested in this book is the kind of daily aggressions that move through a family, right? So we end up taking for granted. So, for example, there's a poem in there about a woman who is disciplining her child in the supermarket, for example, right? And it's the kind of thing that we've seen all the time, and we kind of overlook it.
We just saw it in Baltimore with this
mother. And we just saw
it
in Baltimore, absolutely.
Who's been all over the news.
Right. So it gets celebrated in some cases, and it gets vilified in other cases. And I was interested in sort of analyzing those situations. I think also, when we talk about race, there are polite levels of discourse around race, and I'm interested in disrupting the more typical stories. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in disrupting the ways we perform race, the expectations around the performance of race. Yeah,
I wonder whether or not you think that poetry is still pregnant with the kind of power that it once had to prick society's conscience. And I raise that because we literally just a year ago now, mm-hmm. lost Maya Angelou.
Absolutely.
Celebrated poet, mm-hmm. like a mother, a surrogate mother to me.
To you, yeah.
I think of the powerful work of Amira Baraka. I think of Nikki Giovanni. I think of Robert Frost. I think I could do this all day long.
Sure, yeah.
These, Gwendolyn Brooks, Gwendolyn all these Brooks. Great poets. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there was a time when people, you know, and Gwendolyn, of course, the first black woman to win a Pulitzer, Pulitzer yeah. for poetry. Sure. So she mm-hmm. was your predecessor, mm-hmm. and she's a woman, obviously, but... Mm-hmm. There was a time, though, when people could express themselves via their poetry and society would take note and wrestle with it. Dylan did the same thing. He just put music to it. Yeah. But what do you make of the place of poetry in our society today?
I don't think people read poetry anywhere near as much as we should. Mm-hmm. And part of it, the upside of that is the popularity of spoken word. I think there's a place where mm-hmm. a lot of social change can be sort of infiltrated throughout the culture.
Is that poetry to you, spoken word? Is that
absolutely poetry to you? Okay. No, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, my calling was to the page, and, right. and part of the reason I gravitate toward the page is because I'm a more introverted person, mm-hmm. right? And I'm interested in moving the words around in a more visual sense. But I think the spoken word is a great place for the kinds of challenges that you're referring to now. For the page to be as effective a tool in social change as mm-hmm. you're talking about, I think something will have to happen in terms of education, mm-hmm. in terms of how poetry is handled in the schools. In my experience, people are afraid of poetry on the page. Right? There's a sense that the poet had one idea, and you have to get that idea mm-hmm. out of the poem and get it right, or else... You know, you're wrong. And one of the things I enjoy about this book is watching all the ways that people interpret mm-hmm. the poems.
That doesn't offend you as a poet.
Not at all.
That there are multiple interpretations to what you've written.
No, and it keeps me interested in the work as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I think even in writing the poems, I don't have an agenda for the poems per se. Mm-hmm. So I'm not writing saying this is what I want to cause. You know, speaking to this idea of social change. What I do want to do is disrupt and create possibilities for conversation. So there are poems in the book where they strike a nerve in me mm-hmm. that makes me a little uncomfortable, and may not be sure what that is, but it's something I want to think more about.
I want to go back to this comment you made a moment ago, Gregory, about poetry in the classroom. I'm not sure there is such a thing anymore as poetry in the classroom.
Yeah, yeah.
We're barely teaching music in the classroom. Right. We're barely teaching art in the classroom. There is a price I think our society pays long term for those disciplines, those arts being absent the curriculum for school children in this country today. But what say you about the value of teaching poetry, of having kids wrestle with poems and come up with their own interpretations? What's the value of that in the classroom if we could do that again?
So much is about narratives, mm-hmm. right? So much of our lives are based on narratives. We tell ourselves stories in order to live, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the difficulties I experienced in my own educational life was not having narratives to step into. Mm-hmm. And the sense that the only options I had for myself were the narratives that were pre-existing. And it mm-hmm. wasn't until I became more comfortable in reading, comfortable as a reader and comfortable as an active reader, that I began to take that skill and apply it to society, mm-hmm. right? And so what are the different ways we can reimagine the narratives that construct, you know, all the various occupations mm-hmm. one can have, the ways one can move through the world? And I think as a tool in the classroom, teaching students to read imaginatively, right, and mm-hmm. without the idea of you have to get this right, you have to figure out exactly what it mm-hmm. says, you know, but bring yourself to the page and imagine something into the text, that's a liberating force.
I read somewhere in a conversation that someone had you for print that part of the framing of this book was your being a father.
Absolutely.
And having, tell me what I read about you being a father and having some young kids.
Well, I'm not sure what you read.
The anxiety that comes, yeah.
But the... Early on in writing these poems, my first daughter was born, mm-hmm. two, now 10 and 7. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was anxious about being a father. And I think, talk about narratives and having the father that I grew up with, You know, he was a very colorful man, very domineering man, man I admired greatly. But I had some issues and questions about, you know, what does that mean? What lessons am I taking in terms of raising my children? What do I want to pass on? And so I was very anxious about that. And I think, you know, again, speaking into silences, the idea of an African-American man doting on his children is a story we don't hear enough. And, you know, obviously it's all too common.
Yeah.
It's not like the story isn't out there, but it's not something that that makes its way into our art, it makes its way into our popular culture very often. And so I wanted to add to that.
Yeah. I want to ask you, before my time with you ends, to read a piece from your book. The book is called Digest, the winner of the 2015 Pulitzer Prize by Gregory Partlow. This piece is called Written by Himself. Written by Himself. Might you read this for me?
Sure.
Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Written by Himself. I was born in minutes in a roadside kitchen, a skillet whispering my name. I was born to rainwater and lie. I was born across the river where I was borrowed, with clothespins, a harrow tooth, broadside sewn in my shoes. I returned, though it please you, through no fault of my own, pockets filled with coffee grounds and eggshells. I was born still and superstitious. I bore an unexpected burden. I gave birth. I gave blessing. I gave rise to suspicion. I was born abandoned outdoors in the heat-shaped air, air drifting like spirits in old windows. I was born a fraction and a cipher and a ledger entry. I was an index of first lines when I was born. I was born waist-deep, stubborn in the water, crying, ain't I a woman and a brother? I was born to this hall of mirrors, this horror story. I was born with a prologue of references, pursued by mosquitoes and thieves. I was born passing off the problem of the 20th century. I was born. I read minds before I could read fishes and loaves. I walked a piece of the way alone before I was born.
I see why. Gregory Partlow is the winner of the 2015 Pulitzer Prize. For those who have situations that you're going through, or friends who are going through situations where they're about to give up, I'm just reminded that Gregory Partlow is a living epistle, that we should never, ever give up on our dreams. Everybody in New York City passed on this book, and when the right person found it and gave it the love and the attention it deserved, it goes on to win the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for 2015. So stay with those dreams. Gregory, congratulations on Digest.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
congratulations,
it.
Man. Good to have you on. The book, again, is called Digest by Gregory Partlow. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Actress Kristen Davis is best known for her role as Charlotte in the Sex and the City franchise, of course, but she's also a dedicated philanthropist. In 2009, Kristen joined the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust in Kenya, which heals and raises orphaned elephants and aims to stop elephant poaching. She's brought that work to the screen as executive producer of a documentary about the Wildlife Trust called Gardeners of Eden, which debuted on Pivot TV. Before we start our conversation, here now a clip from the film.
You know, elephants are born essentially very fragile. Actually losing the mother and being rescued compromises the immune system. They come in with the last of their energy. They're sort of charging around. But if they've ingested mud or anything into their lungs, there's nothing we can do about it. Despite everything we do to save elephants here, I see it as a holding action. What we're doing is giving some elephants another chance of life, so that hopefully when things improve for elephants worldwide, there'll still be some left. Ivory has to be banned. It should be totally outlawed. Something that CITES, the International Convention for Trade in Endangered Species, has to do. because the legal sale of so-called legal stockpiles enables illegal ivory to be laundered into the system, and that's been proved. And until China absolutely puts its domestic market out of bounds completely, elephants are going to continue to be killed in Africa.
When I saw this thing, this is quite an adventure.
Yeah. It is really something. Part of the reason I made the documentary was because I felt like people don't know what's going on. And I'm so lucky that I know this organization and that I get to go and I've met these elephants. I know their names. Mm-hmm. I know their stories. And I feel so lucky and honored to be able to try to be part of it. And I thought, you know, I want other people to see this because, number one, they don't even know what's happening. Yeah. And what would it be like if one day we opened the paper and it said, there are no more elephants in the wild? Mm. Wouldn't you just be like, what? Yeah. What? What is happening? But I feel like there's so many things taking the news and sometimes it's all political, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And people don't know about the really big, important things. And I wanted people to feel how I feel when I go.
You know, the thing that was fascinating for me, and I felt stupid, quite frankly, when I realized this, I guess I thought that this poaching thing was in the past.
Yes.
I had no idea that it was still...
I think that's how everyone feels. Yeah. That's how I felt when I met the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust in 2009. I found this baby elephant. I was on safari. It was very dry. I was with some friends. We found her. It was kind of a drama. We found her. We were very lucky to find her in time. We took her there because everyone in Kenya knows that Daphne Sheldrick has this amazing nursery and can rehabilitate them even without a mother. So we got her there. When I got her there, the head keeper said to me, Edwin, said to me, she's probably a victim of poaching because you were near the border with Tanzania and that's very bad poaching. And I said, poaching? And I thought, well, these might be like these animal people where they're like really kind of a little nutty. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I really didn't know. Mm-hmm. I really thought it was over. But this is the big important fact. Technically, it is banned still. It's that all the bad people in the world have figured out loopholes. Mm-hmm. And that's why Daphne in that cut is talking about how there's so many loopholes in the legal trade, meaning... if it's, you know, before 1979, it's supposed to be legal, but nobody can carbon date these things. Mm-hmm. So the poachers and the people who are paying the poachers to kill the elephants just dye it with tea and tell the antique dealers that it's old and the antique dealers want to make money and they believe it. Yeah. So you can't buy ivory right now. You cannot buy ivory of any kind and know that it's safe. It's probably got blood on it.
Yeah. I thought I was reasonably good at what I do here until
and
I saw
you.
Well, thank you. Until I saw your documentary and I saw that you got a poacher to talk to you.
I personally didn't. I can't take credit for it. I have to say, it was one of those weird things. I was in L.A. at the time.
Yeah.
I hired two young filmmakers to make the film. I went and shot with them, and then I was back here, I think, working or with my child or whatever. Yeah. And I got this very cryptic email from the guy. There was a man and woman team. And he said, I'm going to go out to the village near the gate, and I have someone really important to talk to. And I was like, what? I mean, I couldn't. He was like, because sometimes your emails aren't safe. And he was really beating around the bush, so I had to pick up the phone and call the trust and say, what is Austin talking about? Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, our anti-poaching team has this poacher who's willing to talk on camera.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it. And then I said, I don't want a poacher in my movie. Why would we want a poacher in my movie? But I hadn't seen what he had to say yet. And I have to say, it added a really interesting element in that he talks about how, you know, when the stomach is empty, you can do anything, which is a truth. And then he also talks about how people come to his village and ask him to go in because he comes from a long history of people who lived right near the park. And the middlemen asked him to go kill the elephant. He probably wouldn't think of this himself. And then he made like $144, which for him is a lot. But if you think about the death of an iconic species and the fact that there won't be tourism there if all of them are killed, and all the other animals who are getting caught in the snares, long term, it doesn't make sense at all. But at the same time, when the stomach is empty, one can do anything.
To that comment again, Kristen, it struck me rather viscerally when I heard the comment from the poacher. Because on the one hand, you know, I don't want to repeat what you just said. You care about the wildlife. You care about the elephants. You care about the future of this, you know, beautiful species. On the one hand, on the other hand, people are desperate.
I agree. And I think it's important to look at both sides. You can't leave out the bigger picture. And then I've had a lot of people ask me at film festivals, well, what can you do? Can I sponsor the village? I mean, people are so kind of naive and sweet. And you can't really do something like that. You know, poverty is a really hard thing to change. I've worked with Oxfam for a long time to change extreme poverty, and it's very complex. But at the Trust, what we're doing is we've got a lot of community projects all along the border of the national park where we're employing them to help us police the border and build fences with beehives.
Oh, cool.
So that they're involved, mm-hmm. so that they kind of have a commitment to the conservation as well as getting paid. So that they're getting paid not to poach, they're mm-hmm. getting paid to keep these beehives, they get to sell the honey from the beehives. Elephants are afraid of bees, which is kind mm-hmm. of entertaining. And so the elephants won't go through the fence and mm-hmm. ruin the farmers' land, so that helps. And we're also educating kids. So every day at the Trust, we have like 250 school kids come in yeah. every single day. And a lot of them have never seen an elephant, and they live in Kenya. Yeah. And then we also take, I think last year it was 40,000 kids out to the park, and they've never gotten to go on a, you know, quasi-safari. Yeah. So we want them involved, because if they understand what they're losing. Right.
When you invest yourself in a project like this, What's the hope on the front side? What's the hope that people mm. are going to take away when they see a film like
this? Well, first of all, this is a first for me. Mm-hmm. I have never produced anything in my life. Mm-hmm. I did not know what I was doing, mm-hmm. what I was getting into.
And you did a good job.
Thank you so yeah. much. Let me tell you, I had some tough days. Yeah. I had some tough days, Tavis. I mean, even just saying no, like the producers say no a lot. Yeah. It's not my nature. Mm-hmm. But and then you have to do all this legal stuff, which is also weird. But, you know, awareness was really my goal. And I love Daphne Sheldrick and her daughter Angela, and they are really who I am trying to please and talk to, and I respect Daphne's entire life has been devoted to this. So everything I do for them to try to forward their work and to try to, you know, the keepers that you see who sleep with the elephants, I mean, yeah. they're so devoted. Everyone who works for this organization is so devoted. So if I can just get the word out there of, A, what's happening, they're fighting this war on the ground against terrorists, basically. Mm-hmm. Terrorists and international organized crime syndicates are who is fueling the illegal ivory trade. And then you've got these rangers out there who aren't even funded trying to fight them off, trying to protect the elephants. It's so unbalanced and so kind of heroic and incredible that they're doing it. And I just wanted people to know about it before it's too late.
How seriously is the state taking this issue?
The state of Kenya?
Yeah, yeah, the country.
Pretty seriously. Yeah. You know, maybe I would like them to yeah. be a little more serious. But we work together with the Kenyan Wildlife Service because we're not allowed to carry guns. Right. You know, there's a lot of potential violence in Kenya. So mm. we, like, for instance, if we find a poacher, which recently we did by mistake, kind of, we went into a cave thinking it was empty to get out the poison arrows. We confiscate uh-huh. a lot of stuff, our anti-poaching teams. And the poacher tried to crawl out the other way. Our anti-poaching team went in. Our helicopter pilot was waiting for them outside. He saw the guy crawling out, so he chased him in the helicopter. And then he turned on the siren, and the guy threw his hands up. But the KWS wasn't there yet, so they had yeah. to sit on him until they got there. So I got these really strange pictures of, like, all of our anti-poaching guys sitting on this guy. So luckily the KWS got there, yeah. arrested him. They've changed the laws in Kenya so that they are getting stiffer fines, stiffer penalties. They are taking it a lot more seriously than a lot of countries.
So I know you do work with animals and with human beings. But for the one person who's like, Kristen Davis spent all her time saving elephants, and we got starving people, and we have, yeah, yeah. So what's your response to that?
Well, first of all, I don't spend all of my time doing that because yeah. I have worked for Oxfam for 15 years, mm-hmm. I believe, something really long like that, and the UN, which is a different story. But we're all interconnected. I think in terms of elephants, when we're talking about the extinction of an iconic species, the planet has a self-correcting ability and a food chain that's very mm-hmm. important. And when we start losing iconic species that literally we've taken for granted for our entire history, there used to be 40 million elephants, then there were 10 million elephants, now there are 300,000 African mm-hmm. elephants. You know, they're about to go. Every 15 minutes, one is killed. What is going to happen? There's an entire food chain that they support. All of those animals are going to start dying off. How is the human race going to survive? Not even to mention the fact that El-Shabaab, Joseph Kony, they've all told all their soldiers, go out and kill elephants because ivory is worth more than gold. What do they do with the money from that? They buy weapons to kill more humans. Mm-hmm. We're so interconnected that I don't think you can really separate. Though I do feel like there is an innocence about animals, elephants, mm-hmm. and dogs and whoever else people have shelters for.
Yep.
There's an
mm-hmm.
innocence about them. They didn't really do anything. They're just there trying. Stephen the Poacher says this. Mm-hmm. They're just a life like any other life. They're trying to go about living their lives, and then humans come and kill them. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's, you know, someone has to speak up for them. I mean, I want to speak up for the poor people that no one's speaking for, and mm-hmm. I also want to speak out for the elephants that no one's speaking for. And I also feel like, you know, I get worked out. But I also feel like I just, I feel like the beauty that is in this world has to be protected. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the good people in the world, we're just living our regular lives. We're going to the grocery store. We're trying to take care of our children. We're not necessarily thinking about these other things. But the world is falling apart. We have to stand up. We have to all be activists for what is good in our world.
You did good work.
Thank you.
You did really. Congratulations on the project.
Thank you so much.
And I'm glad we could talk about it.
Me too.
Kristen, good to have you back. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.